Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Shifts Happen. Joining me, my co-host, the man himself, the man who puts the E in Cleveland, Luke Gromman. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? It is actually the best time of year here. So everybody's in a good mood. It's 75 to 85 every day. Most days the Canadians are not sending the smoke down to us. So that's kind. So, you know, things are good. How are you, my friend?
Excellent. I'm well. I've been playing granddad in London with my grandkids, which has been absolutely phenomenal. I'm excited to get a chance to exercise my brain and not my weary body for a while running and chasing around the garden. Thanks for a welcome respite, I have to say. Well, listen, mate, we've got a guest with us this week, which I'm delighted to say, a mutual friend of ours who both of us have known for a while and who is, in my mind, one of the best thinkers in this space. He's been and done many, many things, which I'm going to get him to give us a brief recap on before we get into this for anyone who's not familiar with him. But why don't we just go ahead and welcome our special guest, Josh Crum. Josh, come on in, mate. Where are you?
Hey, Grant. Hey, Luke. Good to be here. Thanks.
Great to have you, my friend. It really is. So you and I bumped into each other in Memphis a month or so ago, and as always, had a fantastic chat, and you always leave me with so much to think about, so thanks for that. It's like I don't have enough to occupy my mind without it getting injected with some pure Josh Crum. But before we get into that and the world around us, which Luke and I have been trying to piece together for a while now, it just seems to be getting harder to do every day given all the moves. For anybody who's not as familiar with your work as we are, just give us a potted background of what you've done and I guess more importantly for this conversation and for you, obviously, what you're doing right now.
Sounds good. So I'm just very, very quick background because I think it'll help some of my biases and thinking and what I've been building. I'm actually a mining engineer by background, but got into the macro side of things after working in M&A in the mining and natural resource space, you know, from the upstream side of the business. I went over to Goldman Sachs, where I was the head of metals research and strategy, working with Jeff Curry and Jim O'Neill during the BRICS era and thinking about the macro side. But as well as that, also our day-to-day business, of course, was working with particularly natural resource companies in their hedging and risk management programs. So really got to understand the infrastructure and the trading of metals markets, in particular, the sector that I covered. So I guess, you know, where hopefully I can add some value to this conversation is that kind of, taking the macro to the actual systems and markets and the infrastructure for trading it. Maybe two other important points of background that might be relevant for this conversation. You know, after I left Goldman, call it at the end of the last commodity cycle, I've really been kind of hyper-focused on this actual physical trading infrastructure and where the intersection of kind of commodities and digital, you know, transformation, call it. So where software and technology meets commodities and market infrastructure. And the two pieces, again, I think could be particularly relevant for this conversation. The first piece of that was a physical gold settlement system that I built in my former business, BitGold, or now called Gold Money. So, you know, very specifically focusing on gold settlement and gold liquidity and the systems that are needed to do that at the real infrastructure layer. And that was focused probably a little bit more on the retail gold space is where the direction it went. But over the last 4 to 5 years, I've been building a company called Abex. And what we're focused on is really building the physical settlement infrastructure for global commodities. You know, what we've been building is our view is, you know, really after, call it, 2 decades of consolidation and digitization, financialization, the commodity markets, we believe that the wholesale infrastructure for trading commodities has really lost touch with some of the physical markets. And so what we're looking at is new benchmarks for particularly growth important commodities like liquefied natural gas, like battery metals, and building new benchmarks out of the physical settlement infrastructure. So again, as a summary, you know, I'm an engineer that has really been focused on building things and particularly building physical settlement infrastructure. Structure and commodities.
Perfect. Well, just listen, let me ask you what seems like a very basic question, but it's one that you're uniquely qualified to explain to people. And I think a lot of people take this stuff for granted. When we talk about physical settlement of commodities, it sounds like such a a simple phrase and it sounds like such a simple thing, but it isn't. So can you just give us a sense of the complexity involved in setting something like that up to just help people understand that it's not as straightforward? So I think when we get into time horizons for all this stuff, it's important to understand what needs to be done here.
Yeah. So I think the most important part about the global commodity supply chain is that by nature, it's international. Unlike a security, which can be very sort of sovereign ring-fenced, you know, here's the laws, here's the rules of one jurisdiction. Commodities have always been this kind of international game theory of negotiating different sovereign boundaries and the rules and risks for crossing those boundaries. And so when we talk about currency markets, we talk about settlement markets, commodities have always kind of been negotiating those movements and the risk management between different sovereign, you know, legal and or political environments. And so that naturally, you know, very much like the FX market, will always have a lot of complexities. But when we think about benchmarks and trading, this is really about how you price a commodity. And, you know, there's, of course, the academic view of a commodity pricing, you know, where marginal cost and marginal demand meets marginal supply. But the realities of these markets, of course, is that that's often very messy and your data is not perfect. So the role of an exchange or the role of market infrastructure is try to bring as much information. How much information can we bring to the market to get that true price assessment? So market infrastructure is all about trying to create transparency and information.
But then the physical settlement component as well, you know, it's not just a simple case of, hey, you know, I'm going to give you some money and I'll send you some gold, or you're going to send me some gold. Again, particularly with reference to gold, because that's, I suspect, going to be a focus of what we're going to talk about in the next little while we're together. So to give us a sense as well of the hurdles in place to creating a trusted, safe, and secure settlement means for physical gold.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes maybe you have to step back to look at some of those sort of mafia movies where the guy shows up with some cash and somebody else has the goods. Are the goods really there? Is the cash really there? Again, and particularly when you're dealing with multiple sovereign jurisdictions and trust could be low, or you're working almost on two sets of rules, it's very, very important to have a framework for how you do that delivery versus settlement. What are your prices? And do we pay a little bit beforehand and then pay after everything's been measured? So these types of settlement issues have always been trying to work out, very much like that simplistic version of a mafia movie. That's exactly what happens in the international commodity trade as well. And of course, there's different rules and payment instructions and measure of commodity instructions that all needs to happen so people can trust each other in what's called settlement finality.
Perfect. With that as background, there has been so much talk in recent weeks of this new BRICS currency. And this is something, Luke, you and I have kicked backwards and forwards for some time now about what the BRICS nations are going to do to try and change the structure of these markets that have been proven, particularly by those treasury actions in terms of sanctioning Russia, to make it an issue really of national security to try and come up with alternative ways to manage reserves. So, Luke, as you've seen kind of the news flow over the last 3 or 4 weeks probably, give us a sense of where you think we are now with this and what the most important moving parts have been, because there's been so many of them.
So the most important moving parts in my mind are actually not around the conversation that seems to be dominating right now regarding this BRICS currency, which is, will they or won't they? Will they do it? Won't they do it? Will they announce it? Won't they announce it? Is the infrastructure there? Is it not there? To me, actually, the most important moving parts are around what is going on in energy markets in particular, which is to say, what's going on with peak cheap energy? What's going on with U.S. shale? What's going on with U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve? And then in turn, what that's going to do in the back half of this year for inflation metrics. And so what I mean by that is, if we take a step back, I think there were two big actions we saw at the beginning of last spring when Russia invaded Ukraine, which was the U.S. sanctioned Russian FX reserves. And then the U.S. also took actions that I've equated to, which were effectively energy swap lines with our allies, which is to say we ran down our SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, at an unprecedented rate in an attempt to get oil prices down to basically, in my view, it was a de facto support of the treasury market, because what we were watching was the high price of energy drive up other commodities. It was pushing energy importing creditors of the United States into twin deficit positions. They were dumping Japan, for his perfect example. Energy prices went up. Japan, when faced with a twin deficit driven by energy, They're dumping treasuries to raise dollars to buy energy. U.S. gets energy prices down. U.S. sanctions Russian FX reserves. All of this succeeds in getting oil prices down to a point. This is where it brings me to where I think is the biggest moving part right now with all of this, which is the U.S.'s gambit was, in essence, get oil prices down and get inflation down and hope Russia breaks before the U.S. banking system breaks and before U.S. shale production begins peaking and rolling over. And the bottom line is that it didn't work. The SPR is largely drawn down. We don't know where the bottom on that is, but we've drawn down a lot. The U.S. banking system began straining so much that the Fed had to basically take some actions back in March. U.S. shale production, while still rising, we've seen rig counts, I think, have been dropping for 9 straight weeks now. It's just a matter of time till we see shale production roll over. And so in the back half of this year, either oil prices go up or you're going to see the U.S.'s ability to manage the oil price wane and Russia's rise, OPEC's rise. And that, I think, has some, as they get more geopolitical power from a timing standpoint, what we're talking about with this, I think it's a largely energy-driven mandate in terms of moving away from the status quo dollar system. My point is that the moving pieces of everything we're seeing, I think we're going to get back into energy inflation, and that's going to be a forcing function to systemic change, basically, one way or another. Either the Fed's got to keep raising rates, that introduces problems, the SPR is drawn down, or we start seeing shale really roll over, which then cedes energy market share to Russia, to OPEC plus. And so I think we're getting into, from a timing standpoint, into sort of this interesting, tricky time.
Josh, I see you nodding away there, as am I. You know, you obviously have a lot of experience in energy markets as well through ABAX and all the other things that you've built over the years. When you look at what Luke's saying, and again, to me, it's every kind of part of that setup is undeniable. It's actually, it is happening. The question that I think everybody gets into is everyone's got their own view about what it all means. And, you know, I do find myself, for the most part, falling into Luke's camp. I think what he says makes sense to me. When you listen to that, what are your first thoughts on it from the energy perspective? Because, you know, you have a framework around energy as collateral, gold commodities as collateral, which I want to come to in a second. But when you listen to that setup that Luke laid out there, how do you view it? Do you see holes in it that you would challenge, or does that make sense to you as an overarching framework?
I do agree with it. I think about it in a very similar framework. Whether we're talking about the geopolitics and particularly this real politics cycle that we've entered into, or we want to talk about changing currency regimes or so forth, it's all very linked to the energy macro environment. One of the big questions is, would Putin have invaded the Ukraine when he did if he wasn't thinking about this energy and U.S. interest rate cycle differently? I think the answer is no. I think it was the energy realpolitik that enabled those actions. And the same thing with thinking about the risks in the global financial system, the euro-dollar system, in essentially a changing rate environment after, call it something like 30 years of structurally falling interest rates, I do think we are going into this phase transition. So again, these things are all very linked. You know, the need to sell more and more U.S. government securities and who's going to buy them, the talk about alternative reserve, both payment systems as well as reserve assets and currency systems, and the structural change in energy flows. These are all very related at the macro level. But I guess the other thing that I think it's important to introduce just for a framework for talking about these things is often we say things like the U.S., China, Russia. We have to remember that this is not the will of broad bases of people, these different countries, but you have to think about the individual actors and incentives of what's happening in these. You know, whether we're talking about Russia and the very specific power and strategies of Vladimir Putin, or we're talking about very specific actors in the CCP within China, I think it's always very important to separate the national interest, the people of these countries, versus the actions of individual actors. And one of the reasons I think it's very important to mention that is if you look very specifically at Vladimir Putin and his background. I happened to live in Russia in the early Putin years. And in fact, I studied at the St. Petersburg State University during the summers as part of my graduate program. And one of my roommates was actually translating Vladimir Putin's mineral economics thesis at the time. So just by kind of dumb luck, I had an insight into the way, from the very early Putin regime, the way he thinks about the world. But very specifically, a lot of people forget, if you go back to the origins of the Eurodollar system, and you go back to really the origins of, call it spot commodity trading, these all kind of link up. And Putin is a master of both physical commodity trading and also currency arbitrage. He was part of the very specific branch of the KGB that really was involved in raising, call it black market cash, often in the early Eurodollar markets, through the arbitrage of commodity trading. So I think that's something that often isn't talked about in the media or when we're talking purely on, you know, sort of geopolitics, is that he's a real operator in the engine room of commodity and foreign currency. And that, in my mind, was an important part of, again, the timing and why this all happened.
You know, it's funny. In today's world, I can already hear that we've been listening to you saying that, going, oh, he's a Putin apologist. Whereas I find it absolutely fascinating. You know, this idea that politicians at that level have a real working understanding of markets is such an important thing, because most seem to be devoid of any kind of practical knowledge and understanding of how these things work. So you mentioned a couple of points. You mentioned the Eurodollar market there a couple of times, and you talked about the problems or the stresses within that. Give us a little breakdown of those, because again, the Eurodollar market is such a huge component piece of the argument around this on both sides. And our mutual friend Brent Johnson has done a fantastic job of laying out one side of that Euro-dollar argument and why it's such an important thing to understand and such an important part of this process and will be instrumental in understanding how it plays out. So when you talk about the issues within it, give us a little understanding of what you mean by that.
Yeah. So again, I think it comes ultimately back to commodities, right? You have local economies in sort of sovereign rules-based jurisdictions. But when you get into the international trade arena, particularly of commodities, there's both the financing and settlement of particularly commodity-based trade internationally. And so that always needed a system of funding and credit that often happened by nature offshore from the jurisdiction. So these markets, and we talk a lot about, say, selling oil and the proceeds from selling oil, but you also have to remember, often the buyer needs credit to buy as well. So there's credits on both sides of the trade. And that's really the origin and the continued importance of the Eurodollar market, is those fundings of long, you know, global supply chains, both on the credit for buyers, as well as the supply and the settlement side of the market. So when I say Eurodollar market, what I'm really thinking about is really the free market. In many ways, it's one of the most unencumbered market. I don't think necessarily the Federal Reserve has a large influence on what happens in the actual offshore market. Now, there's many things they do to try to control that. And I think, you know, particularly with, you know, increased swap lines and so forth, there's a lot of things that central banks try to do to bring that, call it offshore free market, under control. But when I'm talking about the Eurodollar market, what I really mean is the banking market that is less constrained by what's happening domestically.
So with all that as background, Luke, let's get into this peak cheap energy space again, because you know, it's a concept that you've done such a phenomenal job in Forest for the Trees in laying out and explaining. And it's such an important thing for people to understand, because what we've seen are falling oil prices against a backdrop of massively declining SPR and assurances from the Biden administration that they're not about to replenish it anytime soon, which... Again, I mean, I'm sure there's a higher plan here and I'm baffled if I can figure it out, but okay. What do they say these days? You do you, I think is what people say. But let's talk about this peak cheap energy and where we are in that and why it's so important. And I'm at pains to hammer this home because, as you said at the beginning, everyone's been focusing on the gold part of this potential new currency. But if you read every single press release I've read, while gold is a headline being mentioned, underneath it all, it's always commodities. It's always commodity-backed currency, which is, look, what all these countries have in common. They all pretty much, without exception, are significantly resource-rich. So talk about why this oil component, this energy component, this is so important.
I think if we take a step back, and for the BRICS in particular, I think it's important to look at what they are, right? So you have Brazil, you basically have a net commodity exporter, Russia, net commodity exporter, India, net commodity importer, China, net commodity importer, South Africa, net commodity importer, basically. I think it's super important to overlay what Josh just laid out about Putin's background, Putin's understanding of commodity markets, Putin's history of operating in these markets to arbitrage different ratios to generate market outcomes, generate cash. And I think it's important to overlay something Harold Malmgren wrote in January of 2022, which was that when he met Putin, one of the things he walked away from was that Putin was smarter than basically any of the Western leaders that Malmgren was interacting with. But if we take a step back and look at the essence of what these BRICS are in the context of the global debt-backed monetary system status quo as it has existed for the last several decades, peak cheap energy is critical. And I think it is the binding fundamental common complaint that ties them all together that is forcing them to try to change the system. These complaints are not because, oh, I don't like the US, although in some cases that might be the case. Their complaint is if this continues in a peak cheap oil world, our economies will collapse. It is a mathematical certainty. And the reason that is from two sides of the same coin. So let's take the Chinese, for example. They are a net creditor to the United States. So they have dollars flowing in, they've got dollar reserves. They are a massive net energy and commodity importer. So they have dollars flowing out for their commodities. And I'm going to focus on oil because it's easier. But when I say oil, the audience should hear commodities more broadly. And oil, by the way, is the biggest one. So for China, creditor of the US, oil importer, Kyle Bass laid it out perfectly 4 or 5 years ago, which is the way you can blow up China is China has a finite number of dollar reserves. China needs to grow their economy. They are growing their economy. As they grow their economy, their oil imports rise. As their oil imports rise, the number of barrels goes up. As the price of barrels goes up under peak cheap energy, their dollar emissions for that oil, because oil is only priced in dollars, will continue to rise. At some point, they will run out of dollar reserves. And at that point, they will have to either significantly slam the brakes on their economy or massively devalue their currency. Either way, the Southeast Asia currency crisis, inflation, political disruption, complete red line national security threat to China. So that is on the creditor oil importer side, U.S. creditor oil importer side of the BRICS equation. India is really on that side, much smaller creditor, but it's there on the oil and commodity importer side as well. South Africa to a smaller, lesser extent. On the U.S. creditor energy exporter side, Russia, Brazil, and as we've seen, interest from Saudi and others in the Gulf, in the GCC, interest in joining the BRICS, Iran's shown some interest as well. So the issue here is the other side of the same coin, which is Russia is selling oil. They are getting the dollars. In an oversimplified version, they are settling in treasury bonds, financing U.S. deficits. The problem is that in a peak cheap oil world, the price of oil needs to rise, will rise, by more every year than the American government can afford to pay on a coupon on those interests because our debt is so high, right? So let's say just to keep oil production flat globally under peak cheap oil, the Dallas Fed said that they were seeing anywhere from 8 to 10% oil inflation in the U.S. shale basin to basically keep oil flat over the last 4 years. The U.S. government can't afford to pay 8 to 10% rates. They cannot afford to pay those rates to keep Russia's holdings of treasuries flat and in oil terms, to keep the Russian purchasing power whole in oil terms. In that world, Russia's better off leaving the oil in the ground and not buying the treasuries at all, because oil is the better store of value than treasuries.
Well, I mean, Russia has sold all their treasuries, right?
Exactly. What is Russia better served doing? Russia's better served storing their wealth in gold, which they've been doing since 2008, because gold has a very long history of maintaining purchasing power in oil terms. And so that's what Russia's done. It's, as Josh talked about before, it's game theory. It's Putin is employing this game theory. So this group of complaints, yes, some of them don't like the U.S., some of them don't like the geopolitics, but I think it remains poorly understood is It's being driven by a fundamental weak spot slash national security risk from two sides of the same coin, which is in a peak cheap oil world, these countries will march toward financial crises, high slash hyperinflation, and political crises if they don't store either the dollars they earn in trade with which to import oil in something that preserves oil purchasing power, commodity purchasing power, or on the other side of the coin, store surpluses from selling commodities, exporting commodities into the world market in dollars, if they don't store those surpluses in something that preserves purchasing power in commodity terms. And the reality is the US's debt position, deficit position, and peak cheap oil prohibit the US from being able to offer an interest rate that preserves commodity purchasing power using treasuries without putting the sovereign insolvency of the United States not at risk. They can't afford 8 to 10% rates.
Josh, your thoughts on that? Because again, you know, this is, you've been actively tweeting. One of the big components of this on the Western side, certainly, is this move towards digital currencies has been happening rapidly now. It feels like there's more urgency to that now. And it would be very easy to ascribe that urgency to the fact that the Chinese are apparently in, you know, late stage testing of the digital yuan. But to me, it feels like that urgency is coming from a different direction, different vector. So your thoughts on what Luke just said there, and perhaps you can weave in your thoughts on the move towards CBDCs.
In general, I find a lot to agree with Luke. I mean, we think about the world similarly, the nexus of energy, sovereign debt, interest rates. So I probably don't have too much to add there. But one other thing that I think is super important to understand is Russia, although small on an economic scale, you know, just GDP, what they've been able to do is really become the swing spot commodity trader of the world. And particularly given they occupy such a large piece of the Eurasian landmass. So when we think about nominal GDP, people often say, well, you know, Russia's irrelevant. Why aren't we focused more on our natural economic competition with China? But again, I think what's so important is the strategic position geographically, and is also as a marginal supplier in the market of so many commodities. That's really where Russia's power comes from. Obviously, you know, people start talking about nuclear weapons and other sort of legacies of the Cold War. But again, in today's market, and where I agree with Luke, I think very much Russia was declaring an economic war as much as they were a hot war. And this isn't the first time, by the way. If you look at what Vladimir Putin and Russia was doing ahead of the global financial crisis, they were actively trying to push the market into crisis through their, you know, selling down of Freddie and Fannie. In fact, they had bought them up mostly to dump it on the market at the right time. So very often, this is nothing new for Russia. And again, when I say Russia, the particular strategic elements of the Putin regime is to use its levers to attack the Western, you know, call it rules-based order. So this has been happening for a long, long time. So, you know, getting back to where we are with digital currencies, I actually think, again, it was a little bit Russia driving the plot here. Now, I've also spent a lot of time in China, and with my previous business, Gold Money, we actually had formed a joint venture in China to build the gold settlement system that we were building at BitGold. There was actually two different Chinese entities that wanted us to build something very similar. The first was almost the stereotypical, you know, I went to Shenzhen to Tencent and kind of gave a presentation of our whole system. And of course, you know, never got a call back. And, you know, very quickly, you know, they tried to implement something very similar through the red envelope campaigns of Chinese New Year, working with ICBC and trying to create a digital gold there. And then also, you know, working with one of the large gold companies and the Shanghai Futures Exchange, you know, we're also looking at implementing a system in joint venture. But the reason I bring that up that was very important is I spent a lot of time with people, you know, quite high up, the gold proponent of the Chinese Communist Party, and they very much believe that the natural reversion is gold-based settlement. So I think that there's been a long-term thinking in China around gold-based settlement, but there's been a very active, you know, very short-term drive to do this that's really coming out of Russia. And where that overlaps is really looking at one piece of geography that I think gets overlooked quite a bit in this whole shifting global order is Central Asia. And the things that are happening with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where really these interests of both China in securing energy supply lines through Central Asia, both food and energy. That's sort of a geography that the Russia's sort of losing influence. And so there's actually a lot of geopolitics happening there. And that's actually where a lot of the thinking around creating a gold-based settlement currency came out of, was the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a security organization, but also thinking about energy and commodities. And so out of that work, of course, they've been thinking a lot about digital currency. And can we create a gold-based settlement system that ties into a central bank currency settlement system that all becomes very interoperable, and we can kind of, you know, get away with the U.S. dollar system? So that's where some of the long-term thinking of China, Chinese interests wanting to get away from the dollar, particularly the euro-dollar system, because it's something that's very much outside their control. And in the short term, again, call it a geopolitical attack vector that Russia's been taking, that's really where it comes together.
So, Josh, where do you think, as a component to this, the Belt and Road Initiative fits? Because as I go back through this, and I'm in the process of putting a presentation together on all this, I'm going to give in a couple of weeks' time, it's not coincidental that, as Luke has chronicled many, many times, at the point in 2013 that the Chinese central bank said there's no value in us accumulating further foreign exchange reserves, you know, we saw those reserves fall by 25% in the space of a year, and then they've maintained that level. So they've given that up and they're not accumulating anymore. But between the first announcement that they weren't going to accumulate them and them divesting themselves 25%, we saw the Belt and Road Initiative announced. And so an awful lot, it seems to me, has been spent of those reserves on building the BRA. Where does that fit into this whole puzzle, do you think, Josh?
It really comes back to the military side of the equation. So there's two pieces that, again, particular elements within the Chinese Communist Party, they're very concerned about. One is that, you know, they think about every marginal incremental funding of U.S. dollar debt as essentially funding a military, and particularly the Navy-based shipping lanes that were essentially controlled by the U.S. They see every incremental dollar of buying U.S. Treasuries as funding their exact counter-interest. And so part of it is not wanting to accumulate more U.S. military spending. And then the second piece of it is also very specifically by selling those treasuries and funding that overland energy and food supply route through the Belt and Road, that also essentially takes away some of the geopolitical power of the U.S. I think that's a place where they, in a zero-sum thinking, they can take away U.S. military power by not funding the treasury market, but they can also create new supply lines. So this is very much like we think about Putin's invasion of Ukraine, Western companies trying to de-risk their supply chains. That's happening on a geopolitical level as well. It's sort of like in mergers and acquisitions, if you're in an industry and someone makes a hostile takeover of somebody else, and I apologize to take the business realm, because obviously a hot war is a very much worse situation from humanity, but the thinking is very similar, right? In an industry, once somebody makes a hostile attack on somebody else, everybody's in play. And I think we're now in that period where everybody's trying to de-risk and think about the next moves. So I think what China's been doing very specifically after the reactions, not necessarily just the political actions, but what actual companies did to divest of Russia, China's now thinking about the risk that these same companies are going to start pulling out of China even more significantly. So it's less about the government action, but it's the second order of what businesses are doing that China's very worried about. So I think that's what's happening now, is everybody's trying to de-risk their security of food and energy supply, both from a commercial supply chain logistics or a geopolitical strategy perspective. And again, the Belt and Road and the spending in that region in particular is key to all of this.
It's interesting to me because Putin crossing that border into Ukraine made physical supply chains essential to secure, as you say, and we've seen that. But the move by the Treasury to sanction the Russian central bank also made it absolutely imperative to kind of secure financial supply lines. Luke, you and I have talked about this at length before. Given what's happened in the last month with this kind of wall of headlines, particularly with the BRICS summit coming up in August, we've had claims that the Russians have said that a gold-backed currency will be announced. We've had stories that India has already pulled out before it's even been announced. We've had stories about 40 other nations wanting to join the BRICS. There's so much smoke around this. How has this kind of wall of news either confirmed or adapted or changed or morphed your view of the bigger picture and how things play out from here as we head towards that summit?
I actually don't know that it's changed my views a whole lot, other than the possibility that it accelerates what you and I've long thought is some version of the end game, which is gold coming back into the system as a neutral reserve asset, likely at a higher valuation relative to oil at the very least, right? So more barrels per ounce. You know, Zoltan Pozar talked about that. I've written a lot about that in the past as well. Glazyev wrote about that, I think, citing Zoltan as well. The other smoke stuff, to your point, makes it really hard, right? I mean, we're in wartime, right? So the first casualty of wars is the truth. I've taken to sort of a grain of salt, taken a block of salt to a lot of what I hear, right? It's whether it was, hey, how well things are going for the Ukrainians early on, or the island, you know, that told the Russians to bugger off and that was a lie and that Putin was going to be dead with cancer within 6 months and this, that, you know, there was a Russian civil war, complete coup, the country's being taken over, and that was sort of just kidding. And to be clear, it's from the Russian side as well. Obviously, they stretch the truth as well. We're in a war, right? So to Josh's point of everybody is now in play, everything is in play. And so what I'm watching for are signals that are divergences or actions that I can see. So for example, when I see gold completely separating from U.S. real rates in a way that hasn't happened in 40 years since the end of 2022. Something's happening there. There's a reason why gold is really, really easy to manipulate in the short run. And so the fact that it has not reacted to the most aggressive central bank tightening and Fed tightening in 45 years, I think there's informational value, particularly when married with the other facts around that, which is, hey, maybe the BRICS are moving towards some sort of gold settlement. Hey, we've seen a daisy chain of Iraq, Saudi, UAE facilitating the movement of Russian gold, or opening Chinese yuan correspondent banks in Riyadh in a few months in the case of Saudi, or yuan settlement of various commodities. When I see that, and then I see gold separate from US real rates, there's signal value there. I don't fully know what it means. I don't know that it means, hey, it's this BRICS thing is happening this month, but it tells me there's progress being made in that direction, particularly when married with what we've seen with global central bank buying of gold in the aftermath of U.S. sanctions of the FX reserves. You can layer on things like what the U.S. has sanctioned and tried to sort of, I thought Josh made a great point about Russia's punches well above their weight in global markets and commodity markets because they are the swing producer of global commodities, particularly when you think about oil. Yes, Russia's GDP is de minimis, but Russia produces, call it 10 million barrels of oil a day, exports, I don't know, maybe six, something like that. At any rate, a barrel of oil contains an estimated 20, 25,000 man hours of work, right? So if you actually multiplied Russia's GDP by its real energetic impact, right, which is 10 million barrels a day times 25,000 man hours per barrel times 365 days times $20 per man hour, Russia's impact is really, really big. My point here is that if Russia wants to change the system, they can do this by levering their oil power, right? Basically, if Russia is willing to devalue their oil relative to gold, they can make gold bigger in their trade versus have more heavily driven paper markets in the West. They can facilitate change that way. If that kind of thing was happening, I'd expect to see two things. I'd expect to start seeing gold separating from real rates, which we're seeing. I'd expect to see global central banks buying a lot more gold and net selling treasuries, which we're seeing. I'd also expect to see Western officials try their best to basically firewall Russian energy and Russian gold, which we have seen, right? And ultimately, it's something that will fail, but it will buy them time because oil is fungible. We've seen even the Europeans, they're still buying Russian oil. The Americans are still buying Russian refined products. Oil is really, really hard to firewall. Gold is much easier to firewall, but if you connect the two, they start to become fungible, it's problematic, and then you start seeing these market impacts. So bottom line, I don't know what it means, this meeting coming up. It's possible it's a big deal. It's possible it'll be, you know, to Brent Johnson's point, another one of these sort of lots of sound and fury signifying nothing in terms of, hey, we're gonna, and it's, you know, we're planning, but they don't accomplish anything. But when I see these impacts in markets, and when I see the policy reactions of the U.S., I've never seen a U.S. administration in my professional career put up more sanctions on the gold market than we've seen in the last 18 months from the Biden administration. If it's such a irrelevant pet rock, why? You know, it's not like Russia's financing themselves that much with gold. It's, in the grand scheme of things, not a lot of money. So anyway, there was sort of a stream of consciousness there, but that's how I'm thinking about this thing coming up at the end of August, I guess it is.
Josh, you know, you've been involved in the energy markets for such a long time now. And as we've touched on before, you've been trying to build critical infrastructure in those markets to enable a completely different type of marketplace to evolve, a marketplace that really is much more in keeping with the way the broader world outside the commodities markets have gone. So as you've gone through that process, obviously you've talked to every major player in the oil market. So give us a little understanding of what you've seen in terms of dynamics between different regions, what you've seen in terms of any shifts over that period of time, because I know this has been going on for, measure it in years, not months, and where you think the current power dynamics lie in the oil market.
First and foremost, when I look at what we're building, it is for a rules-based order. I do think that we need better commodity benchmarks, better commodity financing, better commodity supply chains, more transparency. And so in many ways, we've been building infrastructure for that physical settlement and better financing of supply chains, very much like some of the geopolitical interests want. But we're doing it because we believe that the euro-dollar market and the over-reliance on treasuries as collateral is also a risk to the rules-based order, not just the geopolitical interests of some BRICS nations. We think that just frankly, the risks in the U.S. Treasury market long-term as being the key piece of collateral to make this whole system work is, again, reaching some kind of endpoint or transition. And I think a lot of the commodity traders, particularly if you look at the sovereign back traders, whether it's in the Middle East or in Asia, they think about this the same way. You know, it's nothing new that the commodity traders in Asia just didn't like always being reliant on trying to source U.S. treasuries for their financing. So, you know, one of the things that we've been doing very specifically at ABEX and some of the work I did before is there's been a lot of innovation on the trading, bringing liquidity to global markets, high frequency trading, the central limit order book. There's been a lot of technology that's come into the front end of trading and messaging, but there's not a lot of technology that's come into the actual supply chain and properly collateralizing physical commodities. And so that's very specifically the work that ABEX has been doing is to better collateralize these supply chains. And maybe another way to look at it is last year when a lot of LNG cargoes needed to be rediverted to Europe, I would actually say the physical supply chain in the industry worked a lot better than the financial supply chain. These demonized energy companies did a great job of actually taking away that energy risk in Europe. But meanwhile, you had the LME almost break. You had extreme volatility in the TTF gas market. So in many ways, the physical supply chain performed better than the financial supply chain if it wasn't for emergency and extraordinary measures of moral hazard in those financial markets. So again, I think they need to get upgrading. So back to your point, I think this is recognized, back to your question, this is very much recognized in most of these regions that we need better financial infrastructure that's not so reliant on the current infrastructure. It's got to evolve. And if it doesn't evolve, we're going to keep running into these problems and crisis where ultimately then you have to change rules. And when you start changing rules, that's where things get into that more volatile political realm. When you all of a sudden start changing the rules or changing the settlement or unwinding prices, this is what I think the physical supply chain, no matter what country you're in, is worried about is rules changing.
Let me ask you, you recently got involved on Twitter. ABS made some very high-profile comments, and you offered some very thoughtful replies about that. And also, this was around, I believe you used the phrase
scarcity token, yeah.
Just give us a kind of rundown on that. What ABS's comments and your thoughts and why you felt it necessary to augment and get involved in that debate, because it seemed to rage for 2 or 3 days on my timeline.
So a number of people sort of within ABEX and close to ABEX are close to some of the Saudi leadership. And One of them was at a dinner with FABS and asked very specifically about his meeting with Xi and the currency questions. And the response from ABS was China would like us to consider using a gold and other metals backed currency. So, you know, I know some of this has been in the news, but this was kind of a secondhand direct feedback that that's been on the table. My understanding is that ABS responded. That's very interesting, but we've had a very close relationship with the US and US dollar for a long, long time. And it's something we would have to consider. So that was, you know, I know it's secondhand, but sort of confirming some of the things, you know, that we've read in some, you know, maybe less credible sources, that those conversations are happening to talk about a metal-backed settlement system for Saudi oil. Now, what's interesting about that is not just the gold piece, but the and other metals piece. And again, this is just my personal view, but I think what that gets back to is I do not believe that, again, particular elements within the CCP want a, call it a Euro-Yuan system. You know, you got the onshore CNY and the offshore CNH. Let's use that. I don't think they want a CNH system that effectively grows to work like the Euro-dollar system has, where essentially, you know, call it the free market is in control of the money creation and the financing supply lines and so forth. I think they want more. Even though it's outside of their borders, I think they want more control of that. And one of the things that I've speculated is by going to the central bank digital currency route for a CNH is that essentially they can create a bearer token, almost like a physical bill that limits supply. Rather than just having a growth in bank ledger, if you want a critical mineral that's tied up into a Chinese supply chain, you actually have to deliver a actual scarce CNH. So CNH can't be just created in different, you know, Western bank ledgers. It actually has to be delivered as a scarce token that they can very quickly revoke or change. Now, of course, when you hear about the popular conversation on Twitter or whatever about CBDCs, it's all about that control and monitoring of retail flows and political speech and everything else. But I think in the wholesale settlement system that China really wants to be a part of and drive, they want to have that same wholesale control of things that happen with the CNY or CNH outside of their border. And if you look at Enbridge, which is one of the infrastructures that the technology is essentially being driven by the PBOC and has partners in the UAE, Thailand, and I think there's one other, but there's a number of players contributing to this wholesale CBDC settlement system. And I think it's very much in line with that thinking that it's a much more controlled and orderly network. It's outside of SWIFT. It's outside of the US-based correspondent banking network that's very decentralized and very outside of control of either the Fed or the PBOC. So I think that's something that's very important to think about.
One thing that jumped out at me was something you said earlier about concerns about the long-term outlook for continuing to use treasuries as collateral. And just sort of flesh that out a bit more in terms of what the concerns are around it as you talk to market participants. What does it look like as that starts to break down? In other words, as we start to see the manifestation at some point, or maybe they're already in place, of concerns about the continued use of that, be it market-related or geopolitical-related. And then what is, I would assume that you and I have had conversations about, okay, more physically driven collateral. What replaces that? What's the timeline for replacing that? And that could probably feed into some of what you guys are doing at ABEX.
It's tricky because the scale of these markets are so important, both on the providing credit to a buyer of international commodities, as well as the credit that's needed to actually take a, say, $100 million LNG cargo in transit. That takes a lot of capital. And if you're not properly collateralizing the underlying commodity, first you have to go into a repo and acquire treasuries, and then you've got to pledge the treasuries, and then you've got to finance. So there's such a complex system of credit, both on the supply side and on the demand side, that you need a significant amount of collateral in the system. And thinking about physical commodities, to put this in context, the crude oil market is something like a $2 trillion flow market. But as you know, you can't really store crude for any meaningful time without paying a very high, call it negative interest rate carry on that crude. So probably the actual, call it the rolling stock of crude, might be something like half a trillion. And that compares to what, a 7.5 $5 trillion foreign holding of U.S. treasuries. So again, the size and liquidity of the offshore treasury market just dwarfs that of other commodities. So that's why it's been needed to facilitate this type of trade. Now, gold is interesting, and that's sort of the opposite of oil, of course, right? So gold is more like a $200 billion market, but because it lasts forever and because it's actually held both in jewelry form, which can be very quickly melted and recycled, as well as financial form, you probably have something like 10 to 12 trillion of above ground stock of gold that could be used in that collateral system. So that actually does compare okay to say, you know, the 7 trillion in US sovereigns. But all commodities, you're talking about probably something like 4 trillion in flow, but maybe 1 trillion that could be sort of collateralized. So again, you know, gold becomes a very important element. This, even though it's only 1/10 the size of this of the crude oil market, its stock is much, much bigger and could be comparable to the offshore treasury market. And then also, if you think about, again, to put this all into context, the paper bill market globally, you know, I did this work, you know, 7 years ago or something. I think we estimated it was around $6 trillion in actual physical hard currency. Again, call it physical token currency from central bank reserves. Now, if you digitize that, you could also create a larger bank reserve token out of a CBDC that's not necessarily a sovereign debt instrument. Again, once you get to the intricacies, you know, a lot of this becomes the same thing. But ultimately, I think that's another piece of collateral. And then just, again, just to throw some data out there for people to think about, I think there's actually other key pieces of collateral that have not even entered the equation yet. If you think about a sovereign bond market, you know, what you're really collateralizing is tax and income stream of a sovereign jurisdiction. I think there's a lot more that can be done around data assets and actually, you know, tax streams off of, say, the attention economy that right now is completely being collected by companies like Meta and Google. But I think there could be data assets that become collateral. So I guess my point is, I think the collateral system is constantly changing. It's important to understand scale, and it's important to understand where those shifts could happen.
It's funny you say that, Josh, because this idea of collateralizing tax streams, I mean, that's double-edged sword, right? It really is, because the way the world is at the moment, if you start to base investment decisions around collateralizing tax streams, there's only one thing that's going to happen, and that's higher taxes, because we all know how that movie plays out, right? And so coming back to Luke's original point about the actual finances of these governments, and obviously that comes down to tax receipts, ultimately, it's the only income they get. This does create a massive problem when a significant amount of those tax receipts are being forced to be diverted towards interest payments as opposed to entitlement spending, defense spending. You know, Luke, just coming back to you before we close, given that picture that you are more familiar with than I am, certainly you've done a lot more excellent work on it, and what Josh has just rolled in there about potential ways for these CBDCs to work, what does that mean for your view on this in terms of the indebtedness problem that the U.S., I mean, we'll talk about the U.S. government because that's one you've done the most work on, but the reality is we could stick a pin in a world map and chances are better than 80% we'd find a government with similar problems.
And to me, you know, one of the things that jumped out that Josh said is something I've started to hear a bit about. I've not done a whole lot of digging on it, but is the appropriate valuation of data and the attention economy in the context of all this. So a perfect example, I have a good friend of mine who's very deep in that world, and he pinged me. He goes, Luke, there is a, you know, Fortune 10 consumer products company in Ohio. Guess what they hold the value of their data on their corporate balance sheet at? And I said, zero. He goes, zero. He goes, you know, and I know that that data ain't worth zero. I said, oh, absolutely. So he kind of laid out a situation where not only is data across the corporate world wildly undervalued, and we know that they're basically all, if not all, valuing it at zero. But when you get into things like UBI, et cetera, right now, Josh made the point that Meta and Google are taking the whole rake. In other words, every day by virtue of the three of us living, we are generating mounds of data. And that data is accruing to a very small number of companies that make them very profitable. But if that flow started to go the other way, and started to be valued at some level, and then had a payment mechanism stream over top of it, off of which a government could take their cut, it gets really interesting in terms of a mechanism to extend and improve the finances of highly indebted Western sovereigns. What it starts to look like is almost like a version of a sales tax, right? Or equitable sales tax basis of collection, which, you know, so, hey, I drive my car and that means I generated data off my car and I went to this store, that store, that store, and it all picked it up. And by virtue of my activity, I did this and I got on Twitter and I interacted. Luke, today you made whatever, $2 based on your data, and the government's going to take 50 cents of that and away. I don't know how, but writ large over an economy, it rings up some really interesting questions of some potential solutions would married or overlay. So it's a little bit of stream of consciousness, but when Josh said that, it sort of it brought that to mind. And I think it's a really interesting point that would conceivably, they're working on trying to get infrastructure there. It isn't there, but if you got the infrastructure there, it's of course a question. There's some politics as well, because obviously you're gonna be taking money out of some people's pockets that are having a lot of money flow into their pockets as a result of the status quo. But it would potentially meaningfully change some of the calculus in terms of the urgency of what I've talked about around the U.S., specifically the West more broadly, in terms of like, we have an acute fiscal crisis. It isn't someday. It isn't in 5 years. It is now, based on some of the things we've highlighted in the past.
Yeah, maybe, you know, again, I've thought a lot about this. And again, if you think about even some of the things that ABEX has been doing, it's typically around, you know, I have this macro view, I have this view of where these things are headed. And so what are the business opportunities in there? And so I've thought a lot about this attention tax and, you know, ultimately what it looks like, again, drawing on my resource background, is at the end of the day, the attention economy is an extractive economy. And I believe governments will eventually get around to taxing it in a very similar way. So not based on income, but based on actual top line royalties on attention and data, maybe a time-based royalty. So if you think about a company like Meta that has ultimately, I think it's 16, 17% effective tax rate, but that's not in every jurisdiction, right? That's already very global. You look at a natural resource company, they're probably all in between royalties and, you know, and income taxes and all of the taxes through an extractive industry. You're probably paying something like 40, 45% effective tax rate in many jurisdictions. But the key thing is because they're paying that top line royalty on extraction. So if you think about something like the customer acquisition lifetime value model of data, you know, and user acquisition, it could be a monthly fee per citizen that Meta essentially just has to pay to the government. And there's going to be different systems of identity that will layer into this. So again, we've kind of come full circle, and all of these things become very related, whether it's income streams on tax and sovereigns, it's energy, it's sovereign CBDCs and data economies. So again, this is kind of the world I look at, and the infrastructure to sort of counter the negative pieces of where this could all go. That's the type of things that I've been thinking about and the types of things I've been investing in.
It brings it full circle perfectly. There is so much going on here, and there's been a big focus recently, I guess, because this BRICS summit is coming up. There's been a big focus on the BRICS. There's been a big focus on what they may do to kind of try and redress the balance in their favor, given the way the system is kind of skewed against them in terms of its operability and its convenience and, as you say, its taxing ability. But then you come back to the West, which has a different but similarly intractable set of problems. And the answers, whichever way I look at it, the answers are higher taxes in the West, and the answers are more autonomy in the East, or the global South, if you prefer. And as we said at the top of this conversation, you know, the argument seems to be between a group of people who think it's going to happen tomorrow and a group of people it's going to happen never. And to me, it's pretty simple here to say this is, if it doesn't happen, it won't be because one side isn't desperate to make it happen. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why maybe it won't, but I think the weight of evidence is leaning heavily towards this being the direction of travel. And the question is really just rate and not direction. Josh, mate, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. For anybody out there who isn't familiar with you and ABEX, just let people know where they can read more about you personally, social medias and stuff, and also ABEX, because it's a phenomenal project.
Thanks, Grant. I think probably my Twitter, easiest to find, just search my name, Josh Crum. And also we've got a podcast called Smarter Markets, which you know, you've been gracious to be involved in the past. And so we spend a lot of time talking about market infrastructure in different pieces, building up from people much smarter than myself and sort of open sourcing as much information as we can to help us build smarter markets. Because ultimately, I believe we need to fight for the rules-based order, not necessarily a Washington consensus or a geopolitical aspect to it, but you know, fight for markets and for peace. And you know, that this is sort of my contribution to it.
Fantastic. Mate, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And you are welcome back on Shift Saturn with Luke and I any time you've got something to say. So please come back and join us whenever you feel like it.
Thanks, sir.
Luke, mate, as always, great pleasure spending another hour with you, or an hour and whatever it was. You know, this story fascinates me like few others in the space right now. And you have been doing such a phenomenal job of chronicling this for years now. And feelings like this is where the rubber meets the road for you and a lot of the things you've laid out. I mean, I don't think there'll be anybody listening to this that isn't familiar with Forest for the Trees and the work you do there. But just in case, let them know where they can find out more about your phenomenal product.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's same thing. Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen, and online fftt-llc.com, our website for more information about what we're up to and various institutional retail products.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Until next time. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.